So my name is Bob Olson. I'm an alcoholic. And a member of the Happy Way group in Englewood, Colorado. I didn't pick the name. It sounds like a bunch of people running around on Thorazine. I would prefer a name like Beaten Into a State of Reasonableness group. Somehow sounds more manly, I think. It's by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've not found a need or an excuse to take a drink today, nor have I found a need or an excuse to take a drink since May 28th, 1973, and for that I'm truly grateful. You know, I know Mary has 44 years, but I'm starting to feel like a dinosaur. I chaired a meeting last Sunday in my home group, and there were these two ladies that were doing what Mickey had talked about earlier, and how grateful they were that they were waking up next to people that they knew. And I was sitting there thinking about these two ladies, and I said, "Where the hell were you when I was drinking?" And the one said, "I wasn't born yet." So she's going to be on my next inventory. This is all true. Later she came up and she made amends to me and told me that she really was 5 years old when I quit drinking, and that made me feel much better. Hey, I'm the one that rode in the limousine. So, Franny and Mickey, my name goes in the first column. It's spelled O-L-S-O-N. God. This is an interesting podium. It's like being a preacher. I never really wanted to do that. I love that limousine. God, was that nice. I mean, I have never been put into a back of a car that had handles on the inside. You could get out of that anytime you wanted. That was a very generous thing to do, and I appreciate it. I didn't come all the way out here to tell about drunk stories, so I hope that isn't what you came for. As long as I only have a limited amount of your time, I'm just going to talk about my experience in recovery in AA and how the steps have worked in my life. And the only thing I can really do is to share that experience with you and to say that AA works. When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was in 1968. I obviously didn't get sober. It took me five years of AA meetings to get sober. I'm this sort of constant retread that shows up in your meetings. And usually comes in blitzed or under the influence of some sort of substance. I just couldn't get the picture. Although I always knew that the solution was here. And I went from AA to AA occasionally from 1968 to 1973. And then finally in 1973, my alcoholism got so bad that I finally got in the position that the book describes, when it says that you can't take a drink and you can't not take a drink. I reached a point in my life where I knew if I took another drink, it would kill me. And I'm not talking about feeling bad. I'm talking about dying. And I knew if I didn't take another drink, it would kill me, because, you see, I had had this experience of withdrawal before, and at that point in time in that part of the country, there weren't any treatment centers. And so we always had the privilege of sitting alone someplace, or sometimes with other people, and just shaking it out. On this particular occasion, I had drank an awful lot. I don't know what had happened. I was in a long blackout, and I woke up on the floor of an empty house. My family had gone. And I woke up looking up at two people from Alcoholics Anonymous. One of them was my old sponsor, one of these guys that appoints himself when new people come through the door, and I had called him about 3 weeks previously and told him that I had given the whole subject a great deal of consideration and that I wasn't really an alcoholic and that I was obviously wasting his time, but I was very grateful for the consideration he had given me and that that I wished him the best. He said that they would probably see me again. And he did. He was staring down at me on the floor. And he was a really nice guy. He had brought this new guy with him. And I was going into DTs at the time. And this guy was staring at me, and he was jumping around like a marionette. And he was going, "Is he going to go into convulsions? Is he going to go into convulsions? What's going to happen? Is he going to die?" I mean, if I would have had a gun, I would have shot the son of a bitch. And they were, you know, the old deal was to fill you full of orange juice and honey. What an awful combination. And that's what they did. They took me to a halfway house and sat me down in front of a priest. And the priest asked me some questions. He said, "Are you an alcoholic?" And you know, for the first time in my life, I really knew that I was. I mean, I come from a long line of alcoholics. My family's been dying from this disease ever since I got here from Norway. I mean, my last one to die from it was my dad, and I was the one that they had always said was just like him. I mean, when I was 10 years old, they were telling me, "You're going to die in a gutter just like your father." Now, what the hell kind of a thing is that to say to a 10-year-old kid? You know, if you're mad at them, don't tell them that. Because the problem with that is that they believe you. Okay? I don't ever talk to kids like that. I don't tell them they're stupid. You know, if you tell a kid they're stupid, they believe it. You know how many people I sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous that think that they're stupid and clumsy because their parents or somebody else that they thought were an authority told them they were stupid or clumsy? We got to retrain all these people when they come in here. You can see it on their face. Well, anyway, he said, "Are you an alcoholic?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "Is your life unmanageable?" And I said, "For God's sakes, I just got carried in here." And and he said, "Do you want what we have?" And I had no idea what he had, but wanted it. I mean, he could have been everything I despise, and I would have wanted it instead of what I had. And he asked me if I was willing to go to any lengths to get it. And, I was out of gas. I didn't know what the heck I could do. I had tried everything I could. I read Norman Vincent Peale and Dale Carnegie and jogged a mile a day and tried to go to work every day and tried to be a nice person and tried to do all the moral and philosophical things that we can do to become better people, and it wouldn't even slow me down. And he asked me if I believed in God, and I told him no. I think mostly because I was hoping there wasn't one, because I knew how much trouble I was in if there was. I've been down some really muddy roads. And he said, "I suggest you go find one." And I said, "I wouldn't even know where to look." And he said, "Well, why don't you go home and think about it? And when you come back, we'll talk about it." And I said, "Okay." They took me to the halfway house because they didn't know what else to do with me. And they didn't admit me. They sent me home. Okay, so I went home, and these guys dropped me off, and they said, "You're going to have a hard time. If it gets too tough, call us." And I said, "All right." And I went in this empty house, and I went through DTs, and I went through hallucinations, and I went through the most bizarre kind of craziness I've ever experienced in my life, and I got to do it all by myself. In every moment of the next 48 hours, I knew I was going to die. Every minute. At times I was praying to die, and at times I was praying not to die. And at times I was just trying to find out if there was God. I would recommend that to anybody. I would recommend it because you damn sure would never want to do that again. I think it's almost, sometimes I think it's almost a shame that doctors and therapists are so adept at bringing us off of alcoholism, because we never really feel the pain that you're going to feel when you have to go through that all by yourself without the aid of chemicals to come down. The book says we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we're alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we're like other people, or presently may be, which means or ever will be, has to be smashed. I'm not like other people. I'm an alcoholic. I'm just like my dad, okay? And left to my own devices, I will die in a gutter, just like he did. How do I know I'm an alcoholic? You know, I belong to a, I guess what you'd call a fundamentalist group of AAs. I don't know what else to call it. And we do the work over and over again. We start at step one, go to step 12, and then at some point, probably in the next year, we start at step one and go to step 12 again. And every time that I go to start the work all over again, I don't go write an inventory without starting at step one. So when I get to one, even with 20-some years of sobriety, I have to go back in the same position and take this position of maybe I'm not an alcoholic. Okay? Maybe I'm not really. Maybe this has been this sort of 20-year joke. Maybe I've been under this long, delusionary schedule. I don't know what the heck. You know, I have to ask myself those questions. Am I really an alcoholic? And so I look at it, and I remember the times when I was drinking, and I remember that my wife used to come to me and tell me that my oldest son needed boots to go to school in because there was 2 feet of snow on the ground in Wisconsin. And that he didn't have any boots and he'd get pneumonia if he just went in his shoes and it was only 2 bottles of booze and I couldn't do it. Or when she told me that maybe I didn't have any respect for her, but I at least should respect my children and there was no food in the house and it was only a couple bottles of booze. And I couldn't do it. And it isn't because I want to be a bad guy or a jerk, and it isn't because I'm trying to deprive my wife and my children. It's that that I will put alcohol in front of anything. I will put alcohol in front of my own life. That's the way I am. The book talks about a heavy drinker. It says, it casually mentions social drinkers. It calls them average temperate drinkers. I don't know any people like, well, actually I do know some people like that. My sons are like that. And it talks about this heavy drinker, and it says that he looks like a drunk, in that he can do all the things drunks can do. He can wind up in hospitals, he can wind up in jails, he can wind up in front of judges, in the backs of police cars, he can wind up in divorce courts, he can wind up every place that an alcoholic winds up. But if he has sufficient reason, he can stop. If there is a doctor that tells him he's going to die, if there is a spouse that tells him one more time and you're out, if there's a judge that says one more time back here and you do a hard time, a heavy drinker can, as an act of the will, can quit drinking. But what about the real alcoholic? At some point, they always go out of control. Okay? We always lose control. If you're wondering if you're an alcoholic, there are some descriptions in the book. If when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit entirely, which means that if you say, I've had enough trouble with this, alcohol is ruining my life, I'm never going to take another drink, and you drink again. Or if once you start, you have little control over the amount you take, which means that if it's your intent to have 2 drinks on the way home just to sort of loosen up after work, and you have 10 drinks, or you don't get home, or whatever it is, it says you're probably alcoholic. And if you're alcoholic, you may suffer from a disease which only a spiritual experience can conquer. That's not good news. I mean, they told me I had to go find God. And I'm going, I don't think so. And this guy's telling me I need to have a spiritual experience. And what I am totally armed with at that point in my life is now I lay me down to sleep. The book says that if you're even willing to believe that upon this simple spiritual structure, or upon the simple structure of marvelously, well, I can't remember, wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. That's what it says. If we're even willing to believe, if you even kind of think you may, under the right circumstances, want to believe. You know why there's a chapter in the big book called We Agnostics? It's not called They Agnostics. And in the historical writings about Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about the majority of people coming into Alcoholics Anonymous in the beginning, and I suspect today, are agnostics or atheists. Not quite as many atheists. But I think the majority of us were agnostics, and agnostics think there might be a God, but they don't know what it's got to do with them. Okay? And I thought there might be a God, but I was hoping it had nothing to do with me. It's interesting. My favorite chapter in the book is right there, and it's on the second step. And it talks about two groups of people. First of all, let me say something about power. At the beginning of that chapter, it talks about lack of power, that's our dilemma. You know, almost everybody in AA hears that. And our dilemma is that lack of power. If you ever want to test that, I'll give you some things to test, okay? I'll give you some things. That's one of them. If you think you've ever met a drunk that has power in his life or her life, sit down with them and ask them some questions. Ask them if they got the power to stay in a relationship. Ask them if they got the power to keep a job. Ask them if they got the power to keep a roof over their head. Ask them if they have the power to have a checking account that works. Ask them if they have the power to quit drinking. Because drunks have no power in their life at all. And if you look through the book and you pick up all these comments that the book has about power, you see that the next thing it talks about is when we're even willing to believe, it talks about new power flowing in. Okay? And it talks about where to find the power is the purpose of that book. And then we become willing to believe, and it talks about new power flowing in. And then it talks about two different groups of people. And see, when I have to do the second step these days, and sometimes in my life, when I start doing what the book calls making heavy going out of life, that's where I have to come back. The book says that there are two kinds of people. One of them makes really heavy going out of life. There's some things called the bedevilments where we can't seem to be of real help to other people. We're prey to misery and depression. There's a whole list of things in there that go on. And then it talks about another kind of person that has power, peace, happiness, and a sense of direction. Okay? Now, power, peace, happiness, and a sense of direction is everything I've ever wanted in my life. It says that the difference between those two groups of people is that the people who have power, peace, happiness, and a sense of direction have God as the central fact in their lives. Okay? My second step experience was my sponsor walking up to me and saying, "How come you're sober?" This is 3 months after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm still sitting on my hands. Actually, Mickey did a good description of this thing, sitting on my hands, sweating and shaking. Okay? Not saying anything intelligible at all, not that I can today, and just being there. And he came up to me and he said, "Why are you sober?" And see, I'm a salesman. I said, it's because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, bullshit. You've been hanging around AA for 5 years, and you never got sober before. What are you doing differently? And I said, well, I don't know. And he said, well, are you eating differently? And I said, no. He said, are you exercising? And I said, no. And he said, you going to work regularly? No. Well, what is it that you're doing differently? I have no idea. Are you praying? Yeah. Did you do that before? No. Well, would you consider that you are sober today by the grace of a God you don't even believe in? Whoa. I don't know. Well, what else is there? I don't know. Well, consider that. Okay. One of my favorite parts in the book, in We Agnostics, says, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could neither postpone nor evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that God either is or he isn't. See, he's either everything or he's nothing. What is your choice to be? My self-imposed crisis is not my alcoholism. My self-imposed crisis is that I'm dying and I can't stop. Okay? I can't fix myself. I'm dying from a progressive disease that terminates in insanity or death. And I can't stop. I can't fix myself. The book says no human power can relieve my alcoholism, and that means that not only can't I fix myself, it means you can't fix me either. Well, if I can't fix me and you can't fix me, who's going to fix me? The next line in the book is, here we are squarely confronted with the issue of faith. Boy, I'll say, if I can't and you can't, there better be a God or we're all SOL. Let me tell you how we got dogmatic. In 1975, there was an international convention. There were about 17,000 people that showed up in Denver for an international convention. One of the speakers was a guy named Mac Cheater, who is now dead, who was from Winnipeg, from the Golden Slipper Group. And he stood up there and talked about this group. The reason why they call them the Golden Slippers was because no one could stay sober. And so they did what we did. You know, we'd all read the little sheet of paper that says, rarely has a person failed, you know. And I didn't even know I was in the big book the first year I was in AA. And they'd do that, and then one of them would go off to a bar, and they'd kind of get a crew together, and they'd go rescue them, and then somebody else would go off, you know. I always thought AA early on, in the first year, I thought it was like a lottery or something, you know. Every once in a while, your number came up, and you just ran off and got drunk. And I was hoping that never happened to me, because I have to tell you that I can't go through another one of those withdrawals. I just don't have the strength, and I don't have the courage to do that either. And he was talking about that group, and I mean, I know about those groups. Are we under attack? Well, so anyway, he said that they had come up with a startling new idea, and that they were going to try something really different. They weren't going to talk about the steps anymore, okay? And they weren't going to rationalize about the steps anymore. And they weren't going to intellectualize about the steps anymore. They were going to do the steps. And they did. And an amazing thing happened. They started at the forward to the first edition, where it says, to show others precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Precisely how we have recovered. And they did everything that the book said, and they all got sober. Okay? In 1975, we listened to Mac Cheater tell us about that, and there were 15 of us that got together in a group and said, let's do that. Okay? And some of us were in the middle of the work and just went back to step one, and we all went through that work together. And 14 of us are sober today. Okay? And the other one died sober. That's a pretty good record. You know why? Because this program works. Everything that I tell you tonight, everything that I share with you tonight, has to do with this program is perfect the way it is. Okay? Alcoholics Anonymous has always been perfect. The problem arises when someone wants to put their thumbprint on it. Okay? And I don't care whether it's a pop psychologist or whatever the hell it is, but the people that try and put their thumbprint on AA and come in, whether it's individually or in a group, and say it would work better if we did this, are the people that will destroy this program. And the thing that terrifies me is that there's going to be somebody like me out there. And they're going to be dying, and they're not going to know what the hell to do, and they're not going to have any place to go with it. Because I'm the first Olson in about five generations that got to live by virtue of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we heard Mac Cheater, and we started doing this, and we started forward to the first edition, and we did all that stuff, and every time it said pray, we prayed, and every time it said to write, we wrote, and every time it said to make amends, we made amends, and every time it said to do anything, we did it. If it was a direction, we stopped right there and did exactly what it said. And that's the way we proceeded through the book. And when we got to the third step, my sponsor was telling me that alcoholism isn't about drinking. And I'm going, you got to be nuts. It isn't about drinking. My alcoholism is about walking up to a bottle and trying to drink all of it and then find another one. And he said, no, your alcoholism is about selfishness and self-centeredness. Selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. That's what your alcoholism is about. And I went, no, that's some kind of Zen stuff. And he said, if you take care of your selfishness and your dishonesty and your resentment and your fear, you never have to drink again. And I think what's more important for a guy that's as burned out and blown away as you are is that you don't even have to want to drink or want to. You don't even have to want to drink again. And that's what the book says, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problems, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate seemingly without cause. Right. You know that description in there about this actor? You know about how he becomes even more demanding or gracious when people don't do what he wants? Oh, my. You know what? The thing that most people miss in there, by the way, is that they think it's talking about a director. It's talking about an actor. That's not his job. He's not supposed to control the lights and the other players and the ballet and all that stuff that it talks about. He's just an actor. He's just one of the crew, all right? And he's out there telling everybody else what to do, and he's making them mad. Here, let me give you a thing to test. I'll give this because it's in that part of the book. At some point, we made a decision based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. Okay? Test that one. Next time you get hurt, see if you didn't make a decision based on self, which placed you in that position. Okay? I've never found one that didn't work. I always made some decision that I thought was in my own best interest that may not have been in anyone else's best interest. And later people retaliated or something happened to me and I found myself in this position of being hurt. And it was always based on a decision based on self. We got to the third step prayer and my sponsor, as part of this group, said, there's a prayer here and I want you to understand it because it's a commitment. And I don't want to sound spooky, he said, but this will change your life if you do it. And in the beginning, it says, we thought well before making this decision, knowing that we can at last abandon ourselves utterly to him, talking about God. not our sponsors. Although my sponsor believed it was him, I think. I don't know. And so he said, think well about this, because this has to do with abandoning ourselves utterly to God. I know about abandoning. I spent 4 years in the Navy. You get off that ship before it goes down, or it'll take you down with you. And this is talking about abandoning self utterly. That means with no vestiges left. And he said, let me explain this prayer to you. And he said, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. He said, that means that God can do anything with you that he wants. Anything. Make you sick, make you well, kill you, take your kids away from you, make you get divorced, run you off some other part of the globe, make you happy, make you sad, whatever he's got in mind. Okay? Rich, poor, destitute, make any difference. It's his deal. You need to understand that. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. My bondage is truly self. You know, it's just like I'm looking in a periscope that's aimed right straight at my forehead. I can't see you because I'm so damn busy looking at me. You know, all I can see is me. That's why we spend our whole life pole vaulting over mouse turds. It's this idea that we have to add all this drama to everything, and it really doesn't make any difference. You know what? You know what the book talks about self-centered fear, where we worry about what everybody else thinks about us. We're worried about what kind of impressions we make on other people. We're worried about what they're thinking about. You want to know the truth about that? They don't give a shit. They really don't care. They're so busy thinking about themselves that they couldn't care less what's going on with you. And we're going, what kind of an impression am I making? You're not making any at all. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Bearing witness means being an example. Okay? So what it's saying is, take away my difficulties so I can be an example of what you can do to a broken down, burned out, blown away drunk. Let me stand up here and say that 22 years ago, I had nothing, wasn't going anywhere, didn't have any friends, and I was on the edge of death. And that God was kind enough to bring me back from the edge of death and to allow my mentality to come back to some reasonable degree where I can become a useful member of society. God allowed me to go on an adventure, a spiritual adventure, which has been the most exciting thing that I've ever done in my life. And I have to tell you, I have been on the edge. I have done some very exciting things, not the least of which has been people aiming guns at me when I was a bill collector on the north side of Chicago. I have had all the excitement I want for the rest of my life, and I lead a very dull and boring life in the suburbs with my wife and children. And that's what I do. And I would prefer to do that than to ever get back on any kind of fast track, whatever that is. So he told me what the prayer was, and he said, don't say it unless you mean it. Okay? So go home and think about it, and come back in a week. And if you want to do it, you and I are going to get down on our hands and knees and hold hands, and you are going to say that prayer, and you're going to mean it. And if you don't do it, because it'll change your life. And if you run around with half a loaf, that doesn't work in this program. Half measures avail us nothing. So don't ever go into this thing unless you know what you're doing and you undo it. So I came back the next week, and he said, you want to do this? And I said, I really don't. But I don't want to drink again either. And he said, well, why don't you want to do it? And I said, I don't want to give God that kind of power in my life. And, well, that's true. And that is funny. So he said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to do it. And I got down on my knees and I said that prayer with him and my life changed. Now, what's the funny part? The funny part is that God's got all the power anyway, right? But let me share something else with you. In my experience, God is polite, okay? And that means that he will not come into our lives unless we ask him. And he will not come into specific parts of our life unless we ask him. And so if we don't invite God into our lives, don't expect him to be there, in my experience, okay? Because then it just means that I'm running off on self-will just like I did every time before. And so I say, God, please be part of my marriage. God, please be part of my business. God, please be part of my relationship with my children. God, please be part of my relationship with Alcoholics Anonymous. So I did that, and then I got up off my knees, and he said, okay, now it says that unless this is at once followed by a rigorous attempt to clean house, it'll have little permanent effect, and I don't know what that means to you, but what that means to me is that if you don't go right inventory, it's going to wear off. Well, I was hoping that it said, that's been a difficult decision, and take a month off and kind of get your spiritual strength back and then you can think about what's next. Oh, so what's the most compelling statement in the whole big book? Okay, I'll tell you what it is. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. You hear people in meetings go, don't tell them about God. You ain't going to like it. I loved the old-timers when I came in and said, hey, if God drives them out, alcohol drive them back. I believe it, okay? God's the solution in this program. And if you know what the book says? The book says, stress the spiritual feature freely. That doesn't say hide God. That says, tell them that this program is based on God. Which brings up something else that I want to say now so I don't forget it. When we 12-step people in our group, if they're brand new, we bring them in and we take them in the back room and we explain the 12 steps to them and we tell them what we think is the truth. And that is the only thing that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is the 12 steps. That's what we have to offer and everything else arises out of that. And so we set somebody down and go, here's what we can offer you. We can offer you recovery from alcoholism based on these spiritual exercises that have numbers on them for people like you and I. So we know where to start and what to do next, and here's the first one. Okay? And when we get done explaining the first step, we explain the second step, and we explain all 12 steps, and we do it on the basis of what it says in the book about someone coming back to us later and saying, you didn't tell me about that. Okay? So before those people have ever been one day in Alcoholics Anonymous, they know what to expect, okay? There are no bad surprises. If they say at that point that they want to do it, we get them a sponsor and we start them in the work. We don't say, boy, you are really messed up. What we think you ought to do is just kind of sit around here and get well for a while, and then we'll tell you what you ought to do next. Anyone who comes into Alcoholics Anonymous has intuitive thought. Did you know that? It's true. People who are really banged up from alcoholism, who come into AA, know what they need to do and know the people that they need to go to. There's an odd thing that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's called likes attract. Okay? That means that all the bullshitters hang around with all the bullshitters, and all the step workers hang out with the step workers. So you may want to just take a quick look at who you're sitting next to. Why are you laughing so nervously? You just... I had to write an inventory, and he handed me the book, and he said, here's the guide for the inventory. It's right there. It says you write a grudge list, people, institutions, principles that you've been mad at. So I did. I wrote out this whole thing. And I went back to him and said, okay, what do I do next? And he said, I want you to take each one of those resentments and I want you to write down why you were mad at him, but only a couple words because that doesn't really make much difference, why you were mad at them. And then I want you to write down what that affected, your self-esteem, your security, your ambitions, your personal or sex relations, or your pocketbook. And I said, okay. And it took me, it was interesting to hear someone earlier today talk about resenting everybody they'd ever met, which is my experience. Well, you go through this exercise about whether you're better or worse than they are, and if I look long enough, I'm always worse than everybody. I mean, I'll find a reason to resent them, and I did that for years. It just takes too much energy anymore. I don't care. I just don't do that. I mean, So I wrote down this whole long list of people and institutions and principles and why I was mad at them and what it affected. And then I went back to him and I said, I'm done with my inventory. And he said, no, you're not. And I said, what did I miss? And he said, there's another column there. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, read it right here. It says, where were you selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened in each one of those resentments? So I had to go back through this whole thing and see where I was wrong, to see where I had been selfish and dishonest and self-seeking and frightened. And so I wrote for another couple of weeks, and I came back, and I said, okay, I'm done. And he said, no, you're not. And I said, well, what did I miss this time? And he said, the fear inventory. And I said, come on, Don. I'm not afraid of anything. And he said, you're not, huh? And I said, no, I'm not. And I said, you know about me. I was this bill collector on the north side of Chicago. I went through all this stuff. I've been through, almost been shot in a war. I've been through all this stuff. And I'm not afraid of anything. And he said, really? How about snakes? And I said, what kind of snakes? And he said, well, how about rattlesnakes? And I said, well, I wouldn't want to be in a closet with one. And he said, humor me, write down rattlesnakes. And he said, how about spiders? And I said, you mean like black widows? And he said, yeah, that'd be good. And I said, I wouldn't want to get bit by one. And he said, write down spiders. How about failure? Oh, cheap shot. Well, I was supposed to die from alcoholism just like everybody else in my family. And I've always been afraid of that. And he said, write down failure. How about inadequacy? Oh, well. I never felt like I was as good as other people. I always felt like it just, a piece of stuff. And he said, write down inadequacy. How about women? Oh, come on. I guess so. And he said, all right, write down women. How about children? And I said, just the real little ones. Because they hand me these little tiny babies and I don't want to hold them because I'm always afraid I'm going to drop them. And he went, write down infants. How about the police? Oof, you mean like when there's a squad car right behind you? Yeah. Oh, yeah, I don't like that. Write down the police. How about the judges? And I said, one sentenced me to 2 years in the Green Bay Reformatory for assault when I was 17 years old. I thought it was kind of a raw deal. And he said, "Are you afraid of him?" And I said, "Yeah, I think so." And he said, "Write down Judges. Is there anything you're not afraid of?" I guess not. What does the book say? The book says, fear is an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence is shot through with it. I've never met a drunk in my life that wasn't shot through with fear. You know, we call it something else. When I was a bill collector, I used to go out, face guns, face all kinds of insanity, create a lot of insanity too, and then the next morning I couldn't even get out of bed. And I thought I was fearless. And the doctor used to come over when they still made. So I wrote out all these fears and I came back and I said, "I'm done." And he said, "No, you're not." And it's, you know, come on, give me a break. At some point there's an end to this thing. And he said, "Now you have to write a sex inventory." And I thought, oh, this will be fun. You know, I always thought I was Don Juan. When I got done with my sex inventory, I found out I was Elmer Fudd. Well, we cherish those ideas. Oh, my God. So, he asks us to answer some questions. The questions are, it's about relationships. Were they selfish or not? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? He asks us questions about how we relate to other people in a relationship. And I wrote that whole thing out, and I found out that every relationship I had ever had was selfish. In that, I was just in it for what I could get. I just had never been in a relationship where I even considered the other person. And at that point, I had been married for, when I was like 7 years sober, I got divorced, okay? I mean, it just didn't work. It hadn't worked for 10 years. And I got divorced, and I was going through this sex inventory again. And I was looking at those questions about unjustifiably arousing jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness, and I found out that was the way I had relationships, okay? That I used those as tools to keep whatever woman I was in a relationship with off balance. I would use jealousy by staying out late and coming in with, smell like perfume or having lipstick on me or whatever it was. And they would go, "Where you been?" And go, "Out." And they'd go, "Well, you smell like somebody's perfume." And you go, "Well, you know, we were dancing in this bar." "Really? Well, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. That bar closes at 2. "Yeah, well, you know, a bunch of us went out, hung out for a while." "What have you been doing, Bob?" "I just went out." "Get off of my back." Or suspicion. "I know you've been fooling around." "Well, what have you been doing?" "Look, you know there's no anchor on your ass. If you don't like it here, get out." Or bitterness. "Look, you're a bitch. I don't know why the hell I ever married you." That's a really neat way to have a relationship. I mean, relationships like that, unless they're just, and they're all abusive, last about 10 minutes. See, I didn't even know how to communicate. When I was 12 years sober and I went through this, I found a woman that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with. And the one thing that I was absolutely certain of was that I had no idea how to communicate in a relationship. None at all. I was totally unarmed. I mean, I knew that I would get in the middle of that, and with everything that I knew at that point in my life, that I would screw it up as fast as I got in it. And it scared me. And I went to a woman whose name came up in my 11th step. And I went to her and I said, "I need to learn about having a relationship." And she said, "You don't even know how to communicate." And I said, okay. And she said, will you bring your girlfriend over here? And I said, yeah. And so she said, you're mad at her, huh? And I said, yeah. And she said, why are you mad at her? And I said, well, she did this, this, and this. And I went, and then she asked my girlfriend, did you say that? And my girlfriend said, no, I said this. And this woman came back and said, well, what did you hear? Well, I heard her say this, this, and this. And she said, well, I don't think she said that. Okay? And then she said, is there anything else you're mad about? I said, yeah, she did this. And she went to my girlfriend and she said, did you do that? And she went, no. And she said, Bob, you don't listen very well. Maybe you ought to practice listening. And so I said, okay, and this for the next year, this is not a joke. I would walk around when someone said something that hurt me, and I would say, you know, what you said just hurt me. And this is what I heard you say. Is that what you really said? And 99% of the time, that wasn't anything close to what they said. All right? And then she said, you know what else you need to do is you need to sit down across the table when there's a problem and say, there's a problem. And this relationship is too important to me to go any further with without resolving the problem. And as difficult as that's going to be for us to do, I treasure this relationship enough so that it's important to me that we sit down and discuss this. Oh, you know, I'd rather be tarred, feathered, shot, and burned than to ever do anything like that. My God. I mean, that rails against everything I ever learned. But it works. Okay? So I did this whole sex inventory, and I got through with that. And then my sponsor said, look, you probably need to put some take it to the grave stuff in there. And the book doesn't talk about it, but it does talk about putting our whole life story out in front of somebody and illuminating every dark cranny of the past. And so he said, you may want to illuminate some of this take it to the grave stuff. And I said, how'd you know about that? And he said, because everybody's got it. And it usually has something to do about sex. And I said, how'd you know about that? And he said, don't worry about it. It always comes up. And he said, so when you write that stuff out, put it on the front end of your inventory. Because there's no point dancing through this whole fifth step, you know, in fear of what I'm going to think when you tell me this awful thing. All right? So let me share something with you. Unless you've found a way to do it on a spaceship or with a laser or something, half the people in this room have already done it. I'm sorry to tell you. I fifth-stepped with my sponsor. I told him the whole bloody deal, and I expected him to get up and say, I would prefer it if you didn't hang around my family anymore. I know that we have to have this relationship about sponsor-sponsee, but if it's all the same to you, I'd like you to get another sponsor, too. And see, he didn't do that. He got up and he gave me a big hug and he told me he loved me. And then he was glad I didn't. And what I found out from that is that even as bad as I am, you'll love me. And then I may not be what I'm going to be, but I'm as good as I'm going to get today, I think. And that seems to be all right with most of you. And I understand it isn't all right with all of you, and that's, you know, whatever, that's the way it is. So he said, go home, do 6 and 7, and come back to me and talk to me about your amends. So I went home, and it says, taking the book down from the shelf. So I took the book down from the shelf. It says, we reviewed our first 5 proposals, and I went through the first 5 steps to see if the work was solid. And it was. You know, we always have questions about that, but there's a line in the book that says more will be revealed to us. So if you think you may have missed anything, you know, unless you've really done it on purpose, that's just the way it works. Okay? And when you come back and you write another inventory, you'll pick it up. And so I looked at that and I asked God for the willingness to be rid of those things which we found objectionable. And then I said the seven-step prayer and asked God to remove all those things. You know that part about God, I'm now ready that you have all me, good and bad. There's a description in there that I want to share with you. It's a description about people like you and I that go out and drink again. It's the perfect description of the sober alcoholic who takes another drink. It talks about resentment and anger and fear. And it says, for when harboring such feelings, we cut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. And for us, to drink is to die. So I did 6 and 7, and then I got out my resentment list. You know what it says there? It says we made a list of all persons. This is what it says in the book. We made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Next line in the book is we did it when we took inventory. Okay? If you take your inventory out of the directions in the big book, you'll have your amends list. Almost all of it. But if you take somebody else's guide, it doesn't work like that. Okay? So I would encourage you to do your work out of the big book. I made this list of all these people, and he made me take all of these resentments and write down the harm, because he told me he didn't want me making amends to people that I hadn't hurt, and that sometimes in our own self-centeredness and self-importance, we think that we probably harmed everyone. And he said, that's not the case, you're not that important. So you need to see where you've done real harm, and I want you to bring that to me and show me what harm you've done. So I came back there and I did that. And he said, what about your dad? And I said, well, you know, he left when I was a kid. I mean, he was the guy that was always beating up on me. I didn't do anything to him. And he said, well, didn't you tell me that he called you every year on your birthday? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, you told me he's a really bad drunk? I said, yeah. And he said, well, you know, even through this sort of blur of his alcoholism, he found the time to call you every year on your birthday? And I said, yeah. And he said, and well, what did you do? And I said, I hung up on him. And he said, why'd you do that? And I said, well, because half the time I couldn't even understand what he was saying. And he said, yeah, but why did you hang up on him? And I said, because he was an alcoholic. And he said, you're an alcoholic. Well, what is it you want me to do? And he said, you harmed him by holding him at arm's length your whole life because he was an alcoholic. And even in the midst of in the kind of stupor that we experience in alcoholism, he had the courage and the focus to call you at least once a year, and you wouldn't even listen to him. And you harmed him in doing that, and you need to go make amends to him. And I went, look, he's in this army home, and he didn't understand anything. He had this really bad stroke, and they tell me that he isn't capable of any continuous thought or anything. And so, I mean, what's the point? And he said, this is about cleaning off your side of the street. This isn't cleaning off his. This is about cleaning up our stuff. What he did is irrelevant. What you need to do is go clean off your side of the street, and that means I don't care if he understands or not, you drive to Wisconsin and make amends to him. So he's from the Attila the Hun School of Sponsorship. So I drove to Wisconsin. I went to the Grand Army home, and I walked in there, and I said, I'm looking for a guy named Bob Olson. And they said, that's him over there in the wheelchair. And I walked over, and I hadn't seen him for maybe 10, 15 years. And he was just sort of parked in this wheelchair, and I walked up to him, and I said, hi, I'm your son, Bob. And he looked up, and he got very excited about it. And I knew he understood. and I said, I need to talk with you. And I took his wheelchair, and we went in this little room, and I sat down, and I sat in front of him, and I said, I'm an alcoholic. And he got real sad. And I said, I found this program where I don't have to drink anymore, and part of the recovery process is to make amends to people that we've harmed, and I've harmed you, and I regret having done that. And I'm willing to do anything to set that straight. And when I told him that I didn't drink anymore, he got real excited. And I tried to do the right thing with him. And it wasn't too long after that when he really couldn't understand. My dad died of gangrene in a hospital. He had adult onset diabetes, which is a direct result of his alcoholism. So was the stroke. And they started cutting off his feet, because you lose circulation in your extremities. And so they cut off his feet, and then they went to cut one leg off at the knee. And then the doctor went to my uncle and said, you know, we're just going to keep taking pieces off of him until it gets to the trunk of his body, and then this gangrene's going to kill him, and we can either do that now or do it later. But there, you know, this is relentless. There's no choice here. And my uncle decided that they ought to let him die. And my dad knew about it. And he would sit in his wheelchair when anybody that came close to him, because he couldn't talk. And he would scream. He would scream out of despair. And the four horsemen of alcoholism are well, you know what they are. Read the book. Bewilderment, frustration, and despair are the last three. What are they? Terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I knew there was a book person here somewhere. And especially despair. I owed $15,000. This is in 1973. And so I went to my uncle, who was a banker, and said, I owe all this money. He said, how'd you ever get in that condition? And I said, I'm an alcoholic, and I used to run a loan company, and I know how to borrow money. And I did a lot of that, and that's what happened. And he said, well, you got a problem there. And I said, well, the reason why I came to you is because I need to know how to solve the problem. And he said, okay, I'll tell you how to do it. I said, good, I need to know that. And he said, here's how you solve that problem. You start paying now, and you pay till it's paid. And I didn't want to hear that. I wanted to hear win the Colorado lottery, right? So I did. Paid 30% of everything I earned. 2.5 years. After the 2.5 years, I owed $2,500. And I have had a passion my whole life about boats. I grew up in Wisconsin, and there were a lot of lakes there and rivers. And I always equated boats with success. You know, we never had any money. I would go sit on a river or on the bank of a lake, and I'd watch these people ride around in these boats. And I'd go, God, if I ever get successful, I'm going to have one of those. And so when I wasn't being penurious about my financial amends, I would, the boat show came to Denver. And so we hitched up the kids, and my wife and I went. And I was walking around this boat show thinking about maybe when I got done paying my amends, I could go look at a boat. And the Bassmasters had a raffle going, and it was 3 tickets for $10, and they had my money before I remember pulling it out. Okay? And I felt like Jack and the Beanstalk walking home with no cow and a bag full of beans. Until they called me and told me I won. So I went down to this place where they had this boat. It was a Rebel bass boat in a trailer. And back then, They didn't cost it anywhere near as much as they cost today. And I went to the Rebel Bass Boat dealer and I said, how much is that boat worth? And he said, $2,400. And then this Texan came up to me and he said, would you like to sell that boat? And I said, how much would you give me for it? And he said, $2,500. And see, my two sons were jumping around in this boat going, gee, this is really neat, Dad. We can go fishing and we can learn how to go water skiing and isn't this going to be great? And we're going to go out and have some fun at the lake. And boy, wait till we get this boat home and show it to Mom. And they're going through all of this. And what do you do? What do you do? Do you sell it? Pay off your amends? Or do you keep it and continue to pay off your amends? How do you do that? See, there was a line in the book that just glared at me. It says the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. So what do you tell your kids? You tell them the truth, okay? You tell them you screwed up. And that you need to sell the boat to get out of trouble. And that if there is truly a God, one day you'll take them out in the boat. And I did. I sold it. Spent $2,500, you know, sent it off to my creditors. And for the first time in my life, I was absolutely dead even with the world. I didn't have to cross the street to avoid anybody. I mean, I was absolutely debt-free at that point in time. I need to tell you that 5 years later, I bought a 17.5-foot Cobalt with a Boss 302 Ford V8 engine in it that could troll at 60 miles an hour. I've never found a fish that could swim at 60 miles an hour, but but it was fun trying. The point of that is that God doesn't make you go all the way, okay? That there are miracles in this program. And that if you're willing to take the narrow viewpoint about recovery, and you're willing to follow the directions. And the virtue in this program is in following the directions specifically as they're laid out. If you are willing to follow the directions, I can guarantee you that there will be miracles in your life also. And that's my experience and the experience of the people I know in this program. I made all my amends. Ten's about continuing to watch. It's about continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And when we see it, ask God at once to remove it. Talk to someone about it. Make amends if we've harmed someone, and then resolutely turn your thoughts to someone you can help. That's what the book says. You know what the neat part about that is, other than just following the directions, is resolutely turning our thoughts to someone we can help. That's the key. Because the truth is that if I stay in self today, I can get drunk just as quick as I can the first day I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And the way I get out of self is by turning my thoughts to someone I can help. And so that's what I do. It doesn't even say go help them. It says think about helping them. Just get your mind someplace else. Turn the periscope out. 11 is about discipline. Discipline about what to do when you get up in the morning. When you get up in the morning, you say, God, please keep my day free from selfish, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. If I have a problem, please give me intuitive thought or decision. We plan our day, which means I get up and go, okay, I'm going to get out of bed, I'm going to take a shower, I'm going to get dressed, I'm going to go downstairs, I'm going to fix breakfast for my kids, I'm going to do this, I'm going to talk to my wife about this, I'm going to go to work at this point, I'm going to do this, 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 and this in the morning, and then I'm going to have lunch with so-and-so, and I'm going to go out and do this, this in the afternoon. When I get home at night, I want to do this, this, and this with my kids. We're going to have dinner, I'm going to do this and this and this, and then I'm going to go to bed and I'm going to do my 11th step. Okay? Doesn't always work that way, but it works better with a plan. Okay? And that's what the book says. If you can find anything that I've been talking about that it doesn't say in the book, tell me about it. Okay? It says what I do when I go to bed. It says that I review my day. See if I put more into it than I've taken out of it. You know what our biggest problem is? Where's mine? That's what our biggest problem is. You want to be happy? See what you can do for someone else. I will guarantee you that if you take 2 days, only 2 days out of your life, spend one day trying to get everything you can get, and spend the other day giving away everything you can give away, trying to help someone else, that your happiest day will be the day when you're thinking about somebody else. Okay? And there is a lesson in that. I need to see if I need to make amends to someone. It talks about pausing when agitated or doubtful. As we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. That's a wonderful exercise. What it says is if somebody gets in your face or something happens that you don't understand or something's going on that makes you angry or afraid or whatever, step back and say, God, what's going on here? Give me the right thought or action. That will truly keep us out of trouble. It does me. Talks about attitudes. The attitudes are, thy will not mine be done, and I'm not running the show anymore. Okay? I'm just part of the herd here. I'm just another drunk. Twelve's about living this life. This is a spiritual way of life. This is a life of action. This is not about parking out someplace. If you have been fortunate enough to have been given sobriety by the God of our understanding, and you're afraid to get off your butt and go do something, that's your problem. God didn't get us sober so we hide in a corner. The thing that we can do with our sobriety is to go out and risk to find out what we're capable of. What are they going to do, shoot you? I mean, why don't you go find out who you can really be? Why don't you take this wonderful grace that God has given you and test it? Why don't you go out and see what you're really capable of? Why don't you go risk something? I do. You know, and sometimes you fall flat on your face, and what's the difference? Nobody really cares anyway. I mean, it's no more important now than it was when we got in the door. Everybody's so busy watching themselves, they don't care whether you succeed or fail or not. Okay? So go risk. Everybody else is afraid to. I work with a lot of people. There's a saying around Denver that if you don't straighten up your act, you probably wind up getting sponsored by Bob Olson. I'll take them if nobody else wants them. I get the psychopaths. You know, God bless them. You know, if they're scared of them, good. I mean, I've been down as many muddy roads as they have. I don't care. And if I am with God, I have nothing to fear. Let me say something about that. Every time I go to one of these conventions, people go, aren't you afraid to get up and talk? You know, and other speakers have sort of alluded to that. Well, now he's going to have to sweat. I don't. You know why? Because when they told me that I had to find a God of my own understanding, I thought about God the Father. Because mine was never around and I always wanted one. You know, I saw other kids with one and I've always wanted a father. And when I think about God, I think about myself as a child and I have my arm around his leg and he's got his hand on my shoulder and I am absolutely protected. I have nothing to fear. Least of all standing here. We are always in God's presence because he is deep down within us. And that is ultimately where we will find him. So I work with a lot of people, and the only way I'll do that is just to say, well, we need to start at the forward to the first edition, and I will show you precisely how to recover. And it works for everybody. Everybody. Well, there's only one other thing I want to share with you. And that's about getting spiritually centered in an AA meeting. Okay? As a matter of rote, most of us, at the end of every AA meeting, say the Lord's Prayer. But if you're like me, you never pay much attention to it. And at the end of every Lord's Prayer is the truth about us, okay? And the truth about God. And what it says is, "For thine is the kingdom," which means that everything belongs to God. All the stuff, all the people. You know, my wife belongs to God, and my kids belong to God, and my business belongs to God, and my car belongs to God, and my house belongs to God, and everything belongs to God. My life belongs to God. Everything. That's where we learn stewardship. If we're fortunate enough to have someone else in our life, or some money, or some success, or some sobriety, it all belongs to God. And our job is to take care of it. If it is a gift from God, we need to treat it well, and that's where we practice stewardship. For thine is the kingdom and the power. Lack of power is my dilemma. I have no power. I will die in a gutter on my own power. But I have God's power. And if you don't believe it, listen to how quiet it is in here. For thine is the power. It's all God's. It isn't mine. Anytime I think it's mine, I'm going to go down in flames in the glory. Carrying God's message has no glory to it. The glory is God's. We're just the messenger. We're not the message. So all we can do is stand up, do the best job we can in front of some other drunk and say, there is a solution to this, and the solution is God. We've got some exercises for people who are as burned out and blown away as you are, so you don't have to feel the way you do anymore. Forever. Thanks.